Part 5. The Holy War. Chapter 15. Momim. Many have condemned those who joined the Holy War for mercenary reasons, and doubtless, should this humble history find its way into their idle libraries, they will blast me as well. Admittedly, my reasons for joining the Holy War were mercenary. If by that one means I joined it in order to procure ends outside of the destruction of the heathen and the reconquest of Shima. But there were a great many mercenaries such as myself, and like myself, they inadvertently furthered the Holy War by killing their fair share of heathen. The failure of the Holy War had nothing to do with us. Did I say failure? Perhaps transformation would be a better word. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. Faith is the truth of passion. Since no passion is more true than another, faith is the truth of nothing. Agensis, the Fourth Analytic of Man. Spring 4111, Year of the Tusk, Momim.
Remember what I said. Zynemus muttered to Acamian as an aging slave led them into Proyas's immense pavilion. Be formal, be cautious. He's seeing you only to shut me up, nothing more.
Acamian frowned. How times have changed, eh, Zin?
You wielded too much influence over him as a child, Akka. Left too deep a mark. Zealous men often confuse purity with intolerance, particularly when they're young.
Though Acamian suspected matters were a great deal more complicated, he said only, "You've been reading again, haven't you?" They followed the slave through a succession of embroidered flaps, turning left, then right, then left again. Though Proyas had arrived several weeks earlier, the administrative chambers they passed through seemed haphazardly arranged, and in some cases only half unpacked. Acamian found this troubling. Normally, Proyas was fastidious to a fault.
Turmoil and crisis, Zynemus said by way of explanation. Ever since his arrival, he has more than half his staff out in the field, counting chickens.
Counting chickens, Acamian recalled, was a Conryan turn of phrase for futile endeavors.
Things are that bad?
Worse. He's losing this game the Emperor plays, Akka. You do well to remember that, too.
Perhaps I should wait until...
Acamian began saying, but it was too late. The old slave halted at an entrance to a much larger enclosure, swept his hand in a flourish that revealed a darkened armpit. Enter at your peril, his expression said. The room was cooler, more dim. Sensors hazed the interior with the scent of aromatic woods. Carpets lay scattered about a central fire, making the ground a cozy jumble of Aenoni pictograms and stylized scenes drawn from Conryan legend. Reclined among cushions, the prince watched from the far side of the shining hearth. Acamian immediately fell to his knees, bowing. He glimpsed a filament of smoke spiraling from a tiny coal thrown by the fire.
"Rise, schoolman," Proya said. Take a cushion by my hearth. I won't ask you to kiss my knee.
The Crown Prince of Conraya wore only a linen kilt, embroidered with the insignia of his dynasty and nation. A close-cropped beard, now the fashion of young nobles in Conraya, outlined his face. His expression was blank, as though he struggled to suspend judgment. His large eyes were hostile, but not hateful.
I won't ask you to kiss my knee. Not a very promising beginning.
Acamian took a deep breath.
You have honored me beyond estimation, my prince, by granting me this audience.
Perhaps more than you know, Acamian. Never in my life have so many men clamored for my ear.
Regarding the Holy War?
What else?
Acamian winced inwardly. For an instant he found himself at a loss for words.
Is it true you raid the valley?
And father? If you think to upbraid me for my tactics, Acamian, think again.
What do sorcerers know of tactics, my prince?
Far too much, if you ask me. But then everyone and his cousin is an authority on tactics of late, eh, Marshal?
Zynemis glanced apologetically at Akamian.
Your tactics are impeccable, Proyas. It's the proprieties I worry about.
And what would you have us eat? Our prayer mats?
The Emperor closed his granaries only when you and the other great names started looting. But what he gave us was a pittance in. Enough to prevent riots, enough to control us, not a grain more. Even still, Raiden and Wreathy.
Proya scowled and waved his hands.
Enough! You say this while I say that, over and over again. For once I'd rather hear a Carmian speak. Do you hear that, Zin? You've irritated me that much.
From Zynemus's grave look, Akamian gathered Proyas was not joking.
So changed. What's happened to him?
But even as he asked this, Akamian recognized the answer. Proyas suffered, as all men of high purpose must, the endless exchange of principles for advantages. No triumph without remorse, no respite without siege, compromise after anxious compromise, until one's entire life felt a defeat. It was a malady Mandate Schoolman knew well.
Akamian, Proyas said when he did not immediately speak, I have a nation of migrants to feed, an army of bandits to restrain, and an emperor to outwit. So let's dispense with the niceties of Janann. Just tell me what you want.
Proyas's face was a battleground of expectancy and impatience. He wanted to see his old tutor, Akamian guessed, but he did not want to want this. This was a mistake. Involuntary intake of breath.
I wonder whether my prince still recalls what it was I taught him those many years ago.
Those recollections, I fear, are the only reason you're here.
Akamian nodded.
Does he recall what it means to think in terms of possibilities? Impatience regained the heights of Proyas's expression.
You mean to think as if?
Yes, my prince.
As a child, I tired of your games, Akamian. As a man, I simply have no time for them.
This is no game.
Isn't it? Then why are you here, of all places, Akamian? What business could the Mandate have with the Holy War?
This was the question. When one warred with the intangible, convolutions were certain to abound. Any mission without purpose, or with a purpose that had evaporated into abstraction, inevitably confused its own means as its end, took its own striving as the very thing striven for. The Mandate was here, Akamian had realized, to determine whether it should be here. And this was as significant as any Mandate mission could be, since it had become every Mandate mission. But he could not tell Proyas this. No, he had to do what every Mandate agent did, populate the unknown with ancient threats and seed the future with past catastrophes. In a world that was already terrifying, the Mandate had become a school of fearmongers.
Our business?
To discover the truth.
So you would lecture me on truth rather than possibilities?
I'm afraid those days have passed, Drusus Akamian.
You called me Akka once.
No, my lecturing days are over. The best I can manage now, it seems, is to remind people of what they once knew. There are many things I once claimed to know but no longer care to. You must be specific.
I would merely remind you, my prince, that when we're most certain to be deceived.
Proyas smiled menacingly.
Ah, you would challenge my faith.
Not challenge, merely temper.
Temper, then. You'd have me ask new questions, consider troubling possibilities. And what, pray tell, are these troubling possibilities?
The sarcasm was naked now, and it stung.
Tell me, Akamian, how great a fool have I become?
In that instant, Akamian understood the depth to which the Mandate had been crippled. Not only had they become preposterous, they had become stale, a matter of rote. How does one recover credibility from such an abyss?
The Holy War, Akamian said, might not be what it seems. Not what it seems,
Proyas cried with mock astonishment, a rebuke for a teacher who had fatally stumbled.
For the Emperor, the Holy War is a lecherous means to restore his empire. For so many of my peers, it's simply a venal instrument of conquest and glory. For Eleazaris and the Scarlet Spires, it's a vehicle for some arcane who knows what. And for so many others, it's merely a cheap way to redeem a squandered life. The Holy War, not what it seems. There hasn't been a night, Acarmian, when I haven't prayed you're right.
The Crown Prince leaned forward and poured himself a bowl of wine. He offered none to Acarmian or Zynemus.
But prayers, Proyas continued, are never enough, are they? Something will happen, some treachery or small atrocity, and my heart will cry, fie on this, damn them all. And do you know what, Acarmian? It's a possibility that saves me, that drives me to continue. What if, I ask myself, what if this holy war is in fact divine, a good in and of itself?
His breath hung on these last words, as though no breath could follow them. What if?
Is that so hard to believe? Is that so impossible that despite men and their rutting ambitions, this one thing, this holy war, could be good for its own sake? If it is impossible, Acarmian, then my life has as little meaning as yours.
No, Acarmian said, unable to muzzle his anger.
It's not impossible.
The plaintive fury in Proyas's eyes dulled, became waxy with regret.
I apologize, old tutor. I didn't mean to...
He interrupted himself with another draught of wine.
Perhaps now is not such a good time to peddle your possibilities, Acarmian. I fear the god tests me.
Why? What's happened? Proyas glanced at Zynemus, a worried look.
There's been a massacre of innocents,
he said. Galeoth troops under Coethus Sobon cut down the inhabitants of an entire village near Pasna. Pasna, Acarmian recalled, was a town some 40 miles up the river Phaeus, famed for its olive groves.
Does Mathenet know?
Proyas grimaced.
He will.
Suddenly, Acarmian understood.
You defy him, he said.
Mathenet has forbidden these raids. Acarmian could scarce conceal his jubilation. If Proyas had defied his shrier.
I like not your manner, Proyas snapped. What care you?
He stopped, as though struck by a realization of his own.
Is this the possibility you wish me to consider?
He asked, wonder and fury in his tone.
That Mathenet!
A sudden gallows laugh.
That Mathenet conspires with the consult!
As I said, Acarmian replied evenly. A possibility.
Acarmian, I'll not insult you. I know the mandate mission. I know the solitary horror of your nights. You and your kind live the myths we put aside with childhood. How can one not respect that? But don't confuse whatever disagreements I may have regarding Mathenet with the reverence and devotion I bear the Holy Shrier. What you're saying, the possibility you're asking me to entertain, is blasphemous. Do you understand?
Yes. All too well.
Do you have more, then? More than your nightmares?
Acarmian did have more. More because he had so much less. He had Inrau. He wet his lips.
In Sumna, an agent of ours, he swallowed, of mine, has been murdered.
An agent assigned, no doubt, to spy on Mathenet.
Proyas sighed, then shook his head ruefully, as though resigning himself to blunt and perhaps hurtful words.
Tell me, Acarmian, what's the penalty for spying in the Thousand Temples?
The sorcerer blinked.
Death. This?
Proyas exploded.
This is what you bring to me? One of your spies is executed for spying? And you suspect that Mathenet, the greatest shrier in generations, conspires with a consult? These are your grounds? Trust me, schoolman, when ill fortune befalls a mandate agent, it need not...
There's more,
Acarmian protested.
Oh, we must hear this? What, did some drunk whisper some lurid tale? That day in Sumna, when I saw you kiss Mathenet's knee, Oh, yes. By all means, let us speak of that. Do you realize the outrage? He saw me, Proyas. He knew I was a sorcerer.
This forced a pause, but little else.
And you think I don't know this? I was there, Akka. So he, like other great shriers before him, has the gift of seeing the few. What of it?
Akkamian was dumbstruck.
What of it? Proyas repeated. What does it mean other than that he, unlike you, chose the path of righteousness? But what?
The dreams. They've been so forceful of late.
Ah, back to the nightmares again.
Something is happening, Proyas. I know it. I feel it. Proyas snorted.
And this brings us to the rub now, doesn't it, Akkamian?
Akkamian could only stare in bewilderment. There was something more, something he was forgetting. When did he become such an old fool?
Rub? He managed to ask.
What rub?
The difference between knowing and feeling, between knowledge and faith.
Proyas caught his bowl and downed it as though punishing the wine.
You know, I remember asking you about the god once, many years ago. Do you remember what you said?
Akkamian shook his head.
I've heard many rumors, you said, but I've never met the man. Do you remember? Do you remember how I capered and laughed?
Akkamian nodded, smiled wanly. You repeated it incessantly for weeks. Your mother was furious.
I would have been dismissed had not Zin... Always your accursed advocate, that Zynemus,
Proyas said, grinning at the marshal.
You do know you'd be friendless without him.
A sudden pang in Akkamian's throat made it impossible to reply. He blinked at burning eyes.
No, please not here.
The marshal and the prince both stared at him, their expressions at once embarrassed and concerned.
Anyway, Proyas continued hesitantly, my point is this. What you said of my god, you must say of your consort as well. All you have are rumors, Akkamian. Faith. You know nothing of what you speak.
What are you saying? His voice hardened.
Faith is the truth of passion, Akkamian, and no passion is more true than another. And that means there's no possibility you could speak that I could consider, no fear you could summon that could be more true than my adoration. There can be no discourse between us.
Then I apologize. We'll speak of this no more. I didn't mean to offend.
I knew this would pain you, Proyas interrupted. But it must be said. You're a blasphemer, Akkamian. Unclean. Your very presence is a trespass against him, an outrage. And as much as I once loved you, I love my god more, far more.
Zynemus could bear no more.
But surely...
Proyas silenced the marshal with an upraised hand. His eyes reflected fervor and fire.
Zin's soul is his own. He can do with it what he will. But Akkamian, you must respect me on this. I don't want to see you again.
Ever.
Do you understand?
No. Akkamian looked first to Zynemus, then back to Nersei Proyas.
It doesn't need to be like this.
So be it, he said. He stood abruptly, straining to stiffen the hurt from his face. The fire-warm folds of his robe burned where they pressed against his skin.
I ask only one thing, he said brusquely. You know Methinet.
Perhaps you alone he trusts. Simply ask him about a young priest, Paro Inrau, who plunged to his death in the Hagurna several weeks ago. Ask him if his people had him killed.
Ask him if they knew the boy was a spy.
Proyas stared at him with a vacancy of one preparing to hate.
Why would I do such a thing, Akkamian?
Because you loved me once? Without a word, Drusus Akkamian turned and left the two Enrethi noblemen sitting mute by the fire. Outside, the night air was humid with unwashed thousands. The holy war. Dead. Akamian thought. My students are all dead.
You disapprove, Proya said to the marshal. What is it this time, the tactics or the proprieties?
Both, Zynemus coolly replied.
I see.
Ask yourself, Proyas. For once, set scripture aside and truly ask yourself whether the feeling within your breast, now, at this very moment, is wicked or righteous.
Ernest paused. But I feel nothing. That night, Akamian dreamed of Esmanet, lithe and wild upon him, and then of Inrau, crying out from the great black.
They're here, old teacher, in ways you cannot see.
But inevitably, the other dream stirred beneath, the hoary nightmare that always reared its dreadful frame, shrugging away the tissue of lesser, more recent longings. And then Akamian found himself on the fields of Eleniot, dragging the broken body of a great high king from the clamor of war. Kelmomus's blue eyes beseeched him.
Leave me,
the gray-bearded king gasped.
No, if you die, Kelmomus, all is lost. But the high king smiled through ruined lips.
Do you see the sun? Do you see it flare, Seswatha?
The sun sets,
Akamian replied, tears now spilling across his cheeks.
Yes, yes, the darkness of the no-god is not all-encompassing. The gods see us yet, dear friend. They are distant, but I can hear them galloping across the skies. I can hear them cry out to me.
You cannot die, Kelmomus. You must not die.
The High King shook his head, tears streaming from curiously tender eyes.
They call to me. They say my end is not the world's end. That burden, they say, is yours. Yours, Seswatha. No,
Akamian whispered.
The sun. Can you feel the sun? Feel it upon your cheek. Such revelations are hidden in such simple things. I see so clearly what a bitter, stubborn fool I have been. And to you, you most of all, have I been unjust. Can you forgive an old man? Can you forgive a foolish old man?
There is nothing to forgive, Kelmomus. You've lost much, suffered much.
My son. Do you think he'll be there, Seswatha? Do you think he'll greet me as his father?
Yes, as his father and as his king. Did I ever tell you?
Kelmomus said, his voice cracking with heartbroken pride.
That my son once stole into the deepest pits of Golgotharoth.
Yes,
Akamian smiled through his tears.
Many times, old friend.
How I miss him, Seswatha. How I yearn to stand at his side once again.
The old king wept for a moment. Then his eyes grew wide.
I see him so clearly. He's taken the sun as his charger, and he rides among us. I see him galloping through the hearts of my people, stirring them to wonder and fury.
Shush. Conserve your strength, my king. The surgeons are coming.
He says such sweet things to give me comfort. He says that one of my seed will return, Seswatha, and a Nasorimbor will return.
The High King winced and shuddered. Spittle hissed through clenched teeth.
At the end of the world.
Then the shining eyes of Anassarimbor Kelmomus II, White Lord of Trice, High King of Cunaiori, grew slack and dull. The evening sun flashed, then flickered out, and the gleaming bronze of the Norserai host paled in the no-god's twilight.
Our king!
Akamian cried to the grim knights about him.
Our king is dead!
She found herself wondering whether such games were common to the Kamposia Agora. Her back was turned to him, but Esmanette could feel his appraising look. She ran fingers across a hanging sheaf of oregano, as though to see whether it had been properly dried. She leaned forward, knowing that her white linen gown, a traditional hassas, would crease along her buttocks and open along her side, gracing the stranger with a glimpse of her bare hip and her right breast. A hassas was little more than a long bolt of linen cut with an intricately embroidered collar and joined at the waist by a leather girdle. Though it was the garment of choice for free wives on hot days, it was also popular among prostitutes, for the obvious reasons. But she was no longer a prostitute. She no longer knew what she was. Sarcellus's Kepalorin body slaves, Aritka and Hansa, had spotted the man as well. They giggled over the cinnamon, pretending to fuss over the lengths of the sticks. For not the first time this day, Esmanette found herself despising them, the way she had often found herself despising her competing neighbors in Sumna, particularly the young ones. He watches me. Me. He was an extraordinarily beautiful man. Blonde but clean-shaven, square-chested, and wearing only a blue linen kilt with gold tassels that stuck to his sweaty thighs. The network of blue tattoos along his arms meant he was an officer of some kind in the Emperor's Eothic Guard. Other than that, Esmanette knew him not at all. They had encountered one another only a short time earlier, she with Aritka and Hansa, he with three of his comrades. The crush had shoved her against him. He smelled of orange peels and salty skin. He was tall. Her eyes scarcely reached his collarbone. Something about him made her think of strapping health. She looked up and, without knowing why, smiled at him in the shy yet knowing way that simultaneously protested modesty and promised abandon. Afterward, flustered, excited, and dismayed, she had pulled Aritka and Hansa down a quiet byway, peopled by strolling browsers and lined by spice stalls with their heaped flat baskets and curtains of drying herbs. Compared with the reeking crowds, the fragrances should have proven a welcome relief, but Esmanette had found herself mourning the stranger's scent. Now, his friends mysteriously absent, he loitered in the sun a short distance from them, watching them with unsettling candor. Ignore him, she thought, unable to shake the image of his hard stomach pressing against her. What are you doing? She snapped at the two girls. Nothing, Aritka said petulantly, her Shaik heavily accented. The sound of a stick snapping a trestle made all three of them jump. The old spicemonger, whose skin seemed stained the color of his wares, stared at Aritka with outraged eyes. He brandished his stick, raising it to the flax awning. She is your mistress, he cried. The sunburned girl cringed. Hansa clutched her shoulders. The spicemonger turned to Esmanette, raised a palm to his neck and lowered his right cheek, a caste merchant's gesture of deference. He smiled at her approvingly. Never in her life had she been so clean, so well-fed, or so well-dressed. Aside from her eyes and her hands, she looked, Esmanette knew, like the wife of some humble caste noble. Sarcellus had given her innumerable gifts, clothing, unguents, perfumes, but no jewelry. Avoiding her eyes, Aritka stamped from the awning, confirming what Esmanette had known all along. The girl did not think herself Esmanette's servant. Neither did Hansa, for that matter. At first, Esmanette had thought it mere jealousy. The girls loved Sarcellus, she'd assumed, and dreamed, as enslaved girls do, of being more than simply bedded by their master. But Esmanette had begun to suspect that Sarcellus himself had a hand in their attitude. Whatever doubt she might have harbored had been dismissed this morning, when the two girls refused to allow her to leave the encampment on her own. Aritka! Esmanette called. Aritka! The girl glared at her, her hate naked now. She was so fair-haired, she seemed browless in the sunlight. Go home, Esmanette commanded. Both of you! The girls sneered and spit onto the packed dust. Esmonet took a threatening step forward. Beat your freckled ass home, slave, before I... Another snap of the stick across the trestle. The spicemonger scurried from his stall and struck Aritka across the face. The girl fell, shrieking, while the vendor struck her again and again, crying curses in an unfamiliar tongue. Hansa pulled Aritka clear. Then, with the spicemonger still shouting and waving his stick, they fled down the alley. They go home now, the man said to Esmonet, beaming with pride and pressing a pink tongue against the gaps in his teeth. Fucking slaves, he added, spitting over his left shoulder. But Esmonet could only think, I'm alone. She blinked at the tears threatening her eyes. Thank you, she said to the old man. The gnarled face softened.
What you buy? He asked gently. Pepper? Garlic? I have a very good garlic. I winter it very special way.
How long had it been since she was last alone? Since that village months ago, she realized, where Sarcellus had rescued her from being stoned. She shuddered, suddenly feeling horribly on her own. She hid her tattoo in the palm of her right hand. From the day Sarcellus had saved her, she had not once been alone, not truly. Since she'd arrived in the Holy War, Aritka and Hansa had been ever present, and Sarcellus himself had somehow managed to spend a great deal of his time with her. In fact, he'd been remarkably attentive, given the selfishness that seemed to characterize so much of his life otherwise. He'd indulged her on many occasions, taking her here to the Kampoja Agora several times, bringing her to worship at the Chimeral, spending an entire afternoon with her in the Temple of Zothe, laughing as she marveled at its great dome and listening as she explained how the Canaans had built it in near antiquity. He had even toured the imperial precincts with her, teasing her for gawking as they walked in the cool shadow of the Andiamine Heights. But he had never left her alone. Why? Was he afraid she'd seek out a commune? It struck her as a silly fear. She went cold. They were watching Akka. They. He had to be told. But then why did she hide from him? Why did she dread the thought of bumping into him each time she left the encampment? Whenever she glimpsed someone who resembled him, she would instantly look away, afraid that if she did not, she might make whoever it was into a commune. That he would see her, punish her with a questioning frown, stop her heart with an anguished look.
What you buy?
The spicemonger was repeating, his face now troubled. She looked at him blankly, thinking, I have no money. But then, why had she come to the Agora? Then she remembered the man, the Eothic guardsman watching her. She glanced across the alley and saw him waiting, staring at her keenly. So beautiful. Her breath tightened. She felt heat flush her thighs. This time she did not look away. What do you want? He looked at her intently, lingering for that heartbeat that sealed all unspoken assignations. He tilted his head slightly, looked to the far end of the market, then back. She looked away, nervous, a fluttering in her chest. Thank you. She mumbled to the spicemonger. He flapped his arms in disgust as she turned away. Numb, she began walking in the direction the stranger had indicated. She could see him in her periphery, following her through a shadowy screen of people. He kept his distance, but it seemed he already pressed his sweaty chest against her back, his narrow hips against her buttocks, moving, whispering in her ear. She struggled for breath, walked faster, as though pursued. I want this. They found themselves among emptied paddocks, surrounded by the smell of sacrificial livestock. The outer compounds of the temple complex loomed above them. Somehow, without speaking, they closed upon one another in the gloom of an adjacent alley. This time, he smelled of sunburned skin. His kiss was crushing, vicious even. She sobbed, pressed her tongue deep into his mouth, felt the knife's edge of his teeth. Ah, yes, he nearly cried. So sweet. He clutched her left breast. His other hand jostled with her gown, skidded up along the inside of her thighs.
No, she exclaimed, pushing him back. What?
He leaned against her elbows, searching for her mouth. She turned her face away.
Coin, she breathed.
False laugh.
No one eats for free.
Ah, says Janus. How much?
12 talents, she gasped. Silver talents.
A whore, he hissed. You're a whore.
I'm 12 silver talents.
The man hesitated.
Done.
He began digging through his purse, glanced at her as she nervously adjusted her gown.
What's this?
He asked sharply. She followed his eyes to the back of her left hand.
Nothing.
Really? I'm afraid I've seen this nothing before. It's a mockery of the tattoos borne by Jeric priestesses, no? What they use in Sumna to brand their whores.
So, what of it?
The man grinned.
I'll give you 12 talents. Copper.
Silver,
she said. Her voice sounded uncertain.
A bruised peach is a bruised peach, no matter how you dress it.
Yes,
she whispered, feeling tears brim in her eyes.
What was that?
Yes, just hurry.
He fumbled coins from his purse. As Manette glimpsed the halved silver slip through his fingers, she snatched the sweaty coppers. He hiked the front of her hassas and knifed into her. She climaxed almost immediately, blowing air through clenched teeth. She beat feebly at his shoulders with her moneyed fists. He continued to thrust, slow yet hard, again and again, grunting a little louder each time.
Sweet Sejanus,
he hissed, his breath hot in her ear. She climaxed again, this time crying out. She could feel him shudder, feel the telltale thrust, deep, as though he hunted for her very center.
By the gods, he gasped.
He withdrew, pressed himself from her arms. He seemed to look through her.
By the gods,
he repeated, differently this time. What have I done? Panting, she raised a hand to his cheek, but he stumbled backward, trying to smooth his kilt. She glimpsed a trail of wet stains, the shadow of his softening phallus. He could not look at her, so he looked away, toward the bright entrance of the alley. He began walking toward it as though stunned. Leaning against the wall, she watched him find his composure, or a blank-faced version of it, in the sunlight. He disappeared, and she leaned her head back, breathing heavily, smoothing her hassas with clumsy hands. She swallowed. She could feel him run down her inner thigh, first hot, then cold, like a tear that runs to the chin. For the first time, it seemed, she could smell the stink of the alley. She saw the glint of his half-silver among withered, eyeless fish. She rolled her shoulder against the mud brick, looked to the bright agora. She dropped the coppers. She pinched shut her eyes, saw black seed smeared across her belly. Then she fled, truly alone. Hansa, Esmanet realized, had been crying. Her left eye looked as though it might soon swell shut. Aritka looked up from tending the fire. A red welt marred her face. From the spicemonger, Esmanet imagined, but she seemed unscathed otherwise. She grinned like a freckled jackal, lifting her invisible eyebrows and looking to the pavilion. Sarcellus was waiting for her inside, sitting in the gloom.
I missed you, Sarcellus said.
Despite his strange tone, Esmanet smiled.
And I you.
Where have you been?
Walking.
Walking.
He snorted air through his nostrils.
Walking where?
In the city, in the markets. What's it to you?
He looked at her curiously. He seemed to be smelling her.
He jumped up, seized her wrist, and yanked her close, so fast that Esmanet gasped aloud.
Staring at her, he reached down and grabbed the hem of her gown, began pulling it up. She stopped him just above her knee.
What are you doing, Sarcellus?
I missed you, as I said.
No, not now. I have the stink of...
Yes, he said, prying her hands away.
Now!
He raised the linen folds, making an awning. He crouched, knees out like an ape. A shudder passed through her, but from terror or fury she did not know. He lowered her hassas, stood,
stared at her without expression. Then he smiled. Something about him reminded her of a scythe, as though his smile could cut wheat.
Who?
He asked.
Who what?
He slapped her. Not hard, but it seemed to sting all the more for it.
Who?
She said nothing, turned to the bedchamber. He grabbed her arm, yanked her violently around, raised his hand for another strike. Hesitated.
Was it a Kamian?
He asked. Never, it seemed to Esmanette, had she hated a face more. She felt the spit gather between her lips and teeth.
Yes,
she hissed. Sarcellus lowered his hand, released her. For a moment he looked broken.
Forgive me, Esme,
he said thickly. But for what, Sarcellus, for what? He embraced her, desperately. At first, she remained stiff, but when he began sobbing, something within her broke. She relented, relaxed against the press of his arms, breathed deep his smell, myrrh, sweat, and leather. How could this man, so stern, more self-assured than any she had known, weep at striking someone like her? Treacherous, adulterate. How could he?
I know you love him,
she heard him whisper.
I know.
But Esmanette was not so sure. The sorcerer joined Proyas at the appointed hour on a knoll overlooking the vast, squalid expanse of the Holy War. To the east, cupped within the far-flung walls and turrets of Momum, the sun smoldered like a great coal, rising. Proyas closed his eyes, savored the sun's faint morning heat. On this day, he at once thought and prayed, everything changes. If the reports were true, then at long last the interminable debate of dogs and crows, crows and dogs would be over. He would have his lion. He turned to Akamian. Remarkable, isn't it?
What? The Holy War? Or this summons?
Proyas felt chastised by his tone and annoyed by his lack of deference. He had realized he needed a Kamian while tossing on his cot hours earlier. At first, his pride had argued against it. His words of the previous week had been as final as words could be. I do not want to see you again, ever. To repent them, now that he needed the man, seemed base, mercenary. But must he repent his words in order to break them?
Why, the Holy War, of course, he replied nonchalantly. My scribes tell me that more than—
I have an army of rumors to chase, Proyas, the schoolman said. So please, dispense with the genanic pleasantries and just tell me what you want. Akamian was typically curt in the mornings, an effect of the dreams, Proyas had always supposed. But there was something more in his tone, something too close to hatred. The bitterness I can understand, Akka, but you will defer to my station. A covenant binds the School of Mandate to House Nersay, and if need be, I will invoke it. Akamian looked at him searchingly. Why, Prusha? He asked, using the diminutive form of his name as he had as his tutor. Why are you doing this? What could he tell him that he did not already know or could bear to hear? It's not your place to question me, schoolman. All men, even princes, must answer to reason. One night you ban me from your presence forever, then scarcely a week afterward you summon me, and I'm not to ask questions?
I didn't summon you, Proyas cried. I summoned a mandate schoolman under the auspices of the treaty my father signed with your handlers. Either you abide by that treaty or you breach it. The choice is yours, Drusus Akamian.
Not today. He would not be drawn into the morass today, not when everything was about to change. Maybe. But obviously Akamian had his own agenda. You know, he said, I've thought over what you said that night. I've done little else.
What of it?
Please, old tutor, leave this for another day.
There's faith that knows itself as faith, Proyas, and there's faith that confuses itself for knowledge. The first embraces uncertainty, acknowledges the mysteriousness of the god.
it begets compassion and tolerance. Who can entirely condemn when they're not entirely certain they're in the right? But the second Proyas, the second embraces certainty and only pays lip service to the god's mystery. It begets intolerance, hatred, violence. Proyas scowled. Why wouldn't he relent?
And it begets, I imagine, students who repudiate their old teachers, Makamian?
The sorcerer nodded.
And holy wars.
Something in this reply unsettled Proyas, threatened to foment already restless fears. Only his years of study saved him from speechlessness.
Dwell in me, he quoted, and thou shalt find reprieve from uncertainty.
He fixed Akamian with a scornful look.
Submit as the child submits to his father, and all doubts shall be conquered.
The schoolman stared back for a sour moment. Then he nodded with a wry disgust of one who'd known all along the mawkish manner of his undoing. Even Proyas could feel it, the sense that by quoting scripture, he'd resorted to little more than a shoddy trick. But why? How could the latter prophet's own voice, the first and final word, sound so... He found the pity he saw in his old teacher's eyes unbearable.
Do not dare judge me,
Proyas grated. Why have you summoned me, Proyas? Akamian asked wearily. What do you want? The Kunrayan prince gathered his thoughts with a deep breath. Despite his efforts to the contrary, he'd allowed Akamian to distract him with the muck of petty matters. No more. Today would be the day. It had to be. Last night, I received word from Zin's nephew, Arisis. He's found someone of interest.
Who?
A Skilvendi. Now there was a name that gnawed children's hearts. Akamian looked at him narrowly, but otherwise seemed unimpressed. Arisis left only a week or so ago. How could he find a Skilvendi so near Momim?
It seems this Skilvendi was on his way to join the Holy War.
Akamian looked perplexed. Proyas remembered the first time he ever saw that look, as a youth playing Benjuka with him beneath the temple elms in his father's garden. How he had exulted. This time the expression was fleeting.
Some kind of hoax? Akamian asked.
I don't know what to think, old tutor, which is why I've summoned you.
It must be a lie, Akamian declared. Skilvendi don't join in Rethi holy wars. We're little more than...
He halted. But why would you summon me here? He asked with an air of pondering aloud.
Unless... Proyas smiled. I expect Arisis shortly. His courier thought he could be at most only a few hours ahead of the Major Domo's party. I sent Zynemis out to bring them here. The schoolmen glanced at the dawn in their periphery, a great crimson sclera about a golden iris. He travels through the night? When they found the man and his companions, they were being pursued by the Emperor's Kidrahil. Apparently, Irisis thought it prudent to return as quickly as possible. It seems the Skilvendi has made some rather provocative claims. Akamian held out his hand, as though to ward away excessive details.
Companions?
A man and a woman. I know nothing more save that neither is Skilvendi, and the man says he's a prince.
And just what claims has this Skilvendi made?
Proyas paused to swallow away the tremors that threatened his voice.
He claims to know the Fainim manner of war. He claims to have defeated them on the field of battle, and he offers his wisdom to the holy war.
At last, Akamian understood. The agitation, the impatience for his own concerns. Proyas had seen what Benjuka players call the kutma, or the hidden move. He hoped to use this Skilvendi, whoever he was, both to gall and to defeat the Emperor. Despite himself, Akamian smiled. Even after so many hard words, he could not help sharing something of his old student's excitement.
So he claims to be your kutma, he said.
Is what he says possible, Akka? Have the Skilvendi ward against the Fainim?
The southern tribes commonly raid Gedia and Shigek.
When I was stationed in Shima, there was—
You've been to Shima?
Proyas blurted. Akamian scowled. Like most teachers, he despised interruptions. I've been many places, Proyas. Because of the consult. When one did not know where to look, one had to look everywhere. I apologize, Akka. It's just that— Proyas trailed as though mystified. The prince, Akamian knew, had transformed Shima into the summit of a holy mountain, a destination that required warring thousands to achieve. The idea that a blasphemer might just step from a boat— At the time, Akamian continued, there was a great uproar about the Skilvendi. The Kisharim had sent 20 of their own to Shigek to join a punitive expedition the Padiraja was preparing to send into the steppe. Neither the Padiraja's army nor the Kisharim were ever heard from again.
The Skilvendi massacred them.
Akamian nodded. So, yes, it's quite possible your Skilvendi has warred against and overcome the Fainim. It's even possible he has wisdom to share, but why would he share it with us? Within Rithi, that's the question.
Their hatred of us runs that deep?
Akamian glimpsed a howling rush of Skilvendi lancers galloping into the fire and thunder of Seswatha's voice, an image from the dreams. He blinked. Does a Momic priest hate the bull whose throat he cuts? No. For the Skilvendi, remember, the whole world is a sacrificial altar, and we're simply the ritual victims. We're beneath their contempt, which is what makes this so extraordinary. A Skilvendi joining the holy war? It's like entering the sacrificial pens, Proyas finished in a dismayed tone, and striking bargains with the beasts. Exactly. The crown prince pursed his lips, looked out over the encampment, searching, Akamian supposed, for a sign of his dashed hopes. Never before had he seen Proyas like this. Even as a child, he looked so fragile. Are things so desperate? What are you afraid you'll lose? But of course, Akamian added in a conciliatory manner, after Confucius's victory at Kayuth, things might have changed on the steppe, drastically, perhaps. Why did he always cater to him so? Proyas glanced at him sidelong, hooked his lips in a sardonic grin. He returned his gaze to the tangled sweep of tents, pavilions, and alleyways before them, then said,
I'm not so wretched yet, old—
He paused, squinting.
There!
He exclaimed, pointing to nothing obvious that Akamian could see.
Zin comes! We'll see whether this Skilvendi is my Kutma or no soon enough.
From despair to eagerness in the bat of an eye. He'll make a dangerous king, Akamian involuntarily thought. That is, if he survived the holy war. Akamian swallowed, tasted dust on his teeth. Habit, especially when combined with dread, made it easy to ignore the future. But this was something he could not do. With so many warlike men gathered in one place, something catastrophic simply had to follow. This was a law as inexorable as any in Agensis's logic. The more he remembered it, the more prepared he would be when the time came. Somewhere, someday, thousands of the thousands about me will lie dead. The nagging question, the one he found morbid to the point of sickness, and yet felt compelled to ask was, who? Who will die? Someone must. Me? Finally, his eyes sorted Zynemus and his mounted party from the encampment's confusion. The man looked haggard, as could be expected, given that his prince had sent him out in the dead of night. His square bearded face was turned toward them. Akamian was certain that he stared at him rather than Proyas. Will you die, old friend?
Do you see him?
Proyas asked. At first, Akamian thought he referred to Zynemus. But then he saw the Skilvendi, also on horseback, speaking to a wild-haired Arisus. The sight chilled him. Proyas had been watching him, as though keen to gauge his reaction.
What's wrong?
He asked.
It's just been...
Akamian caught his breath.
Been what?
So long. 2,000 years, in fact, since he'd last seen a Skilvendi.
during the apocalypse. He began, then trailed in hesitation. Why did he always grow so shy when he spoke of these things, these real things? During the apocalypse, the Skilvendi joined the No-God. They brought down Kyrenius, sacked Metzonk, and laid siege to Sumna shortly after Seswatha had fled there.
You mean here?
Proya said. Akamian looked at the man quizzically.
After Seswatha fled here,
Proyas explained, where ancient Kyrenius once stood.
Yes, here.
This was ancient Kyrenian soil upon which he stood. Here, only buried as though beneath layers. Seswatha had even passed through Momum once, though it was called Monomora then, and was little more than a town. And that, Akamian realized, was the source of his disquiet. Ordinarily, he had little trouble keeping the two ages, the present and the apocalyptic, apart. But this Skilvendi, it was as though he bore ancient calamities upon his brow. Akamian studied the nearing figure, the thick arms banded by scars, the brutal face with eyes that saw only dead foes. Another man, as filthy and as travel-worn as the Skilvendi, but with the blonde hair and beard of a Norserai, rode close behind. He spoke to a woman, also flaxen-haired, who swayed precariously in her saddle. Akamian pondered them for a moment. The woman looked injured, but found his attention inexorably drawn back to the Skilvendi. A Skilvendi? It seemed too bizarre to believe. Was there a greater significance to this? He'd suffered so many dreams of Anasarimbar Kelmomus of late, and now this, a waking vision of the world's ancient end, a Skilvendi. Don't trust him, Proyas. They're cruel, utterly merciless, as savage as Srank, and far more cunning. Proyas laughed. Did you know the Nansur begin every toast and every prayer with a curse against the Skilvendi?
So I've heard.
Well, where you see a wraith from your nightmare, schoolman, I see the enemy of my enemy. The sight of the barbarian Akamian realized had reignited Proyas's hopes. No, you see an enemy, plain and simple. He's a heathen, Proyas. Anathema. The crown prince looked at him sharply. As are you. Such a blunder. How could he make him understand? Proyas, you must—
No, Akamian, the prince cried. I must nothing. Just this once, spare me your murky forebodings, please.
You summoned me for my counsel, Akamian snapped.
Proyas whirled. Petulance, old tutor, does not become you. What's happened to you? I summoned you for your counsel, yes, but instead you give me prattle. A counselor, as you seem to have forgotten, provides his prince with the facts necessary for sober judgments. He does not make his own judgments, then upbraid his prince for not sharing them.
He turned away with a sneer. Now I know why the marshal frets about you so. The words stung. Akamian could see from his expression that Proyas had meant to injure, had intended to strike as near a mortal wound as possible. Nurse Proyas was a commander, one struggling against an emperor for the soul of a holy war. He needed resolution, the appearance of unanimity, and above all, obedience. The Skilvendi was nearly upon them. Akamian knew this, and yet still, the words stung.
What's happened to me?
Zynemus had reined his black to a halt at the base of the knoll. He hailed them as he dismounted. Akamian had not the heart to respond in kind.
What do you say about me, Zin? What do you see?
Taking their cue from Zynemus, the party milled about their horses for a moment. Akamian heard Orissus chiding the Norserai about his appearance, as though the man were a bond brother rather than a foreigner about to meet his prince. With murmurs and weary steps, they began climbing the slope. Dismounted, the Skilvendi towered over Zynemus, loomed over everyone, in fact, with the exception of the Norserai. He was lean-waisted, and his broad shoulders possessed the faintest of stoops. He looked hungry, not in the way of beggars, but in the way of wolves. Proyas afforded Akamian a final glance before greeting his guests. "Be what I need you to be," his eyes warned. "So rarely is the look of a man a match for the rumor," the prince said in Shaik. His eyes lingered on the barbarian sinew-strapped arms. "But you look every bit as fierce as your people's reputation, Skilvendi." Akamian found himself resenting Proyas's congenial tone, his ability to effortlessly swap quarrels for greetings, to be embittered one moment and affable the next, had always troubled Akamian. He certainly did not share it. Such mobility of passion, he'd always thought, demonstrated a worrisome capacity for deceit. The Skilvendi glowered at Proyas, said nothing. Akamian's skin prickled. The man, he realized, bore a kore tucked behind his girdle. He could hear its abyssal whisper. Proyas frowned. "I know you speak Shaik, friend." "If I remember aright," Akamian said in Kunrayan, "the Skilvendi have little patience for wry compliments, my prince. They think them unmanly." The barbarian's ice-blue eyes flashed to him. Something within Akamian, something wise in the estimation of bodily threat, quailed.
"Who is this?"
the man asked, his accent thick.
"Drusus Akamian," Proyas said, his tone far stiffer now. "A sorcerer."
The Skilvendi spat. Whether in contempt or as a folk ward against sorcery, Akamian did not know.
"But it's not your place to question," Proyas continued. "My men delivered you and your companions from the Nansur, and I can just as easily have them deliver you back. Do you understand?"
The barbarian shrugged.
"Ask what you will."
"Who are you?"
"I am Neyor Uskiota, chieftain of the Utumot."
As limited as his knowledge of the Skilvendi was, Akamian had heard of the Utumot, as had every other Mandate schoolman. According to the dreams, Tsathge, the king of tribes who had led the Skilvendi under the No-God, was Utumot. Could this be another coincidence?
"The Utumot, my prince," Akamian murmured to Proyas, "are a tribe from the northern extremes of the steppe."
Once again, the barbarian raked him with an icy stare. Proyas nodded.
"So, tell me, Neyor Uskiota, why would a Skilvendi wolf travel so far to confer with Inrithi dogs?"
The Skilvendi as much sneered as smiled. He possessed, Akamian realized, that arrogance peculiar to barbarians, the thoughtless certitude that the hard ways of his land made him harder by far than other more civilized men. "We are," Akamian thought, "silly women to him."
"I have come," the man said bluntly, "to sell my wisdom and my sword."
"As a mercenary?" Proyas asked. "I think not, my friend. Akamian tells me there's no such thing as Skilvendi mercenaries."
Akamian tried to match Neyor's glare. He could not.
"Things went hard for my tribe at Kayuth," the barbarian explained, "and harder still when we returned to our pastures. Those few of my kinsmen who survived the Nansur were destroyed by our neighbors to the south. Our herds were stolen, our wives and children were led away in captivity. The Utumot are no more."
"So what?" Proya snapped. "You hope to make the Inrithi your tribe? You expect me to believe this?"
Silence. A hard moment between two indomitable men.
"My land has repudiated me. It has stripped me of my hearth and my chattel. So, I renounce my land in return. Is this so difficult to believe?"
"But then why?" Akamian began in Kunrayan, only to be hushed by Proyas's hand. The Kunrayan prince studied the barbarian in silence, appraising him in the unnerving manner Akamian had seen him appraise others before, as though he were the absolute center of all judgment. If Neyor Uskiotho was discomfited, however, he did not show it. Proyas exhaled heavily, as though coming to a risky and therefore weighty resolution.
"Tell me, Skilvendi, what do you know of Kian?"
Akamian opened his mouth to protest, but hesitated when he glimpsed Zynemus's scowl.
"Don't forget your place,"
the marshal's expression shouted.
"Much and little,"
Nayor replied. These were the kind of responses Akamian knew that Proyas despised. But then the Skilvendi simply played the same game the prince did. Proyas wanted to know what the Skilvendi knew about the Phanom before revealing just how much he needed him to know. Otherwise, the man might just tell him what he wanted to hear. The evasive reply, however, meant the Skilvendi had sensed this, and this meant he was uncommonly shrewd. Akamian ran his eyes along the scarred length of the barbarian's arms, trying to count his swazand in a glance. He could not. Very many, he thought, have underestimated this man. How about war? Proyas asked. What do you know of the Kianin manner of war?
Much.
How so?
8 years ago, the Kianin invaded the steppe, much as the Nansua did, hoping to put an end to our raids on Gedia. We met them at a place called Zukurta, crushed them. These here?
He ran a thick finger across several scars low on his right wrist.
Are that battle. This one is their general, Hazjinet, son of Scorus, the Sapatashar of Shigek.
There was no pride in his voice. For him, war was simply a fact to be described. Little different, Akamian imagined, from describing the birth of a foal on his pastures.
You killed the Sapatashar's son?
Eventually, the Skilvendi said. First I made him sing.
Several of the watching Kunrayans laughed aloud, and though Proyas conceded only an aloof smile, Akamian could tell he exulted. Despite his coarse manners, this Skilvendi was saying exactly what Proyas had hoped to hear. But Akamian remained unconvinced. How did they know the Utamot had been annihilated? And more important, what did this have to do with risking life, limb, and skin, crossing the Nansorium to join the Holy War? Akamian found himself looking over the Skilvendi's left shoulder at the Norserai man who had accompanied him. For an instant, their eyes locked, and Akamian was struck by an intimation of wisdom and sorrow. Unaccountably, he thought, him. The answer lies with him. But would Proyas realize this before he brought them under his protection? Kunrayans regarded issues of hospitality with absurd seriousness.
So you know Kianin tactics? Proyas was asking.
I know them. Even then, I had been a chieftain of many years. I advised the king of tribes.
Could you describe them to me?
I could.
The crown prince grinned, as though he had at last recognized a kindred spark in the man. Akamian could only watch with numb concern. Any interruption he knew would be dismissed out of hand.
You're cautious, Proyas said, which is good. A heathen in a holy war should be cautious. But you've little need to be wary of me, my friend.
The Skilvendi snorted.
Why is that?
Proyas opened his arms, gesturing to the great whirl and scatter of tents that plumbed the distances. Have you ever witnessed such a gathering? The glory of the Inrithi has assembled across these fields, Skilvendi. The three seas have never been so peaceful. All their violence has gathered here. And when it marches against the Phanom, I assure you, your battle at Kaiyuth will seem a mere skirmish in comparison.
And when will it march?
Proyas paused. That might very well depend upon you. The barbarian stared at him dumbstruck. The holy war is paralyzed, Skilvendi. A host, especially a host as great as this, marches on its belly. But Icures Arius III, despite agreements forged more than a year ago, denies us the provisions we need. By ecclesiastical law, the Shrier can demand that the Emperor provision us, but he cannot demand that the Nansua march with us.
So, march without them.
And so we would, but the Shrier hesitates. Months ago, some men of the Tusk secured the provisions they needed by yielding to the Emperor's demands,
which are
to sign an indenture ceding to the Empire all lands conquered.
Unacceptable.
Not to the great names at issue. They thought that they were invincible, that waiting for the rest to gather would simply rob them of glory. What is a mark on parchment in exchange for glory? So they marched, crossed into Fainum lands, and were utterly destroyed. The Skilvendi had raised a contemplative hand to his chin, an oddly disarming gesture, Akamian thought, for a man of such savage aspect.
I cure confus, he said decisively.
Proyas raised his brows in appreciation. Even Akamian found himself impressed.
Go on, the prince said. Without confus, your shrier fears the holy war will be entirely destroyed. So he refuses to demand the emperor provision you, dreading a repeat of what happened earlier.
Proyas smiled bitterly.
Indeed. And the emperor, of course, has made his indenture confus's price. The only way for Mathenet to wield his instrument, it seems, is to sell it. To sell you.
Proyas released a heavy breath.
Make no mistake, Skilvendi. I'm a devout man. I don't doubt my shrier, only his appraisal of these recent events. I'm convinced that the emperor bluffs, that even if we march without signing his accursed indenture, he'll send Confis and his columns to eke whatever advantage he can from the holy war.
For the first time, Akamian realized that Proyas actually feared Mathenet would capitulate. And why not? If the holy shrier could stomach the Scarlet Spires, could he not stomach the emperor's indenture as well?
My hope, Proyas continued, and it's just a hope, is that Mathenet might accept you as a surrogate for Confis. With you as our advisor, the emperor can no longer argue that our ignorance will doom us. The exalt general surrogate? The Skilvendi chieftain repeated.
He shuddered with what Akamian realized a heartbeat later was laughter.
You find this amusing, Skilvendi?
Proyas asked, his expression baffled. Akamian seized the opportunity.
Because of Kaiuth, he murmured in quick Conryan. Think of the hatred he must bear Confis because of Kaiuth.
Revenge?
Proyas snapped back, also in Conryan.
You think that's his real reason for traveling here, to wreak his revenge on Icuri Confis? Ask him. Why has he come here, and who are the others?
Proyas glanced at Akamian, the chagrin in his eyes overmatched by the admission. His ardor had almost duped him, and he knew it. He had almost brought a Skilvendi to his hearth, a Skilvendi, without any hard questions.
You know not the Nansua, the barbarian was saying. The great Icuri Confis replaced by a Skilvendi? There will be more than wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Proyas ignored the remark.
One thing still troubles me, Skilvendi. I understand that your tribe was destroyed, that your land turned against you. But why would you come here? Why would a Skilvendi cross the empire of all places? Why would a heathen join a holy war?
The word swatted the humor from Neyur Uzkiotha's face, leaving only wariness. Akamian watched him tense. It seemed a door to something dreadful had been unlatched. Then from behind the barbarian, a resonant voice declared,
I am the reason Neyur has traveled here.
All eyes turned to the nameless Norserai. The man's bearing was imperious despite the rags clothing him, the mien of one steeped in a life of absolute authority. But it was moderated somehow as though seasoned by hardship and sorrow. The woman, clutching his waist, glared from face to face, seemingly both outraged and mystified by their scrutiny. How, her eyes cried, could you not know?
And just who are you?
Proyas asked of the man. The clear blue eyes blinked, the serene face dipped only enough to acknowledge an equal. I am Anasarimber Kellis, son of Moengus, the man said in heavily accented Shaik. A prince of the north, of Atrathau. Akamian gaped, uncomprehending. Then the name, Anasarimber, struck him like a sudden blow to the stomach, winded him. He found himself reaching out, clutching Proyas's arm. This can't be. Proyas glanced at him sharply, warning him to hold his tongue.
There'll be time for you to pry later, schoolman.
His eyes clicked back to the stranger.
A powerful name,
I cannot speak for my blood, the Norserai replied.
One of my seed will return, Seswatha.
You don't look a prince. Am I to believe you're my equal?
Nor can I speak for what you do or do not believe. As for my appearance, all I can say is that my pilgrimage was hard.
An Anasarimba will return.
Pilgrimage? Yes, to Shima. We have come to die for the Tusk.
At the end of the world.
But Atrithau lies far beyond the pale of the three seas. How could you have known of the Holy War?
Hesitation, as though he were both frightened and unconvinced by what he was about to say.
Dreams. Someone sent me dreams.
This cannot be.
Someone? Who?
The man could not answer.